Therefore, has Schedule 2 entity status under the PSMA. In 2006, we operationalized the area. I took up office then and put the organization together with a reporting framework that allowed us to report to both the Minister of Energy and the Minister of Science and Technology. So under the Canadian framework, we really had two political heads. We had the Minister of Energy and the Minister of Science and Technology, mainly because R&D remains under the ambit of the Department of Science and Technology. They are the custodians of innovation and R&D. And then we officially launched Canary in 2007. If I had to split up Canary's key focal areas into two, it would be on human capital development and energy R&D. And we'll talk through some of the motivation behind it in a second. But if we have to sum up what Canary achieved in those years, it was really building capacity inside the university and outside that will allow us to undertake more R&D in the energy sector. And members here would be familiar with the fact that in the energy sector, South Africa has a proud tradition of innovation. If you look back to TASL, which by the way, Steph started, Steph's quite proud of that, that they started TASL. But in addition to TASL, we also have other successes. Eskom has a dry cooling power technology to make use of arid conditions to store generated electricity. I don't know if you want to mention this table being in the same context, given where we are with PBMR. I think PBMR is a value we're learning exercise. I think this talks to another need, and share with your indulgence, I'll just mention what that need is. There is a need to develop what we call the National Energy R&D Innovation Strategy on that. And the reason for that is clear. At what point did we decide that we want to develop the next generation of nuclear technology, for instance, PEMR? At which point did we decide we want to build the next electric vehicle like we tried to with Optimal Energy's Joule? And even the cell phone, the local cell phone, at which point did we decide it? And how much are we willing to invest? So from an energy perspective, the country needs to decide, do you want to be a world leader, market leader? Do you want to be a fast follower? Or do you want to be a late adopter once the technology is mature? Those are the critical areas that one needs to consider. So the next time we come up with a PBMR type proposal, we are geared up with appreciating exactly what's required to implement it. This applies also to what the next innovative project, which is the thin film solar technology, which has been developed at the University of Johannesburg. And there, Prof. Lynn Albert has been instrumental in setting up the next generation of thin film technology. And unfortunately, we'll be facing the same challenges. How do we get this technology into the local marketplace at a time when we seem to be flooded with imported Chinese, Japanese, photovoltaic panels? So, therein lies the motivation behind such a strategy. So besides human capital development, we also focus on energy R&D. Our primary objective was to set up flagship programs that government can actually utilize in support of various objectives, and I'll talk to those later. But essentially, those two areas form the key focal areas of Sunery. So under the energy R&D, we set up a number of key projects at the universities, in which case they undertook contract research. There are many examples of these key projects, so perhaps we didn't have enough time in this presentation to list all of them, but there have been lots. I mean, at Wits University, we set up a spray injection system, for instance, at Wits, that will allow you to have aerosols, various liquid fuels, so that we can actually come up with more efficient liquid fuel freezer. We also funded the establishment of what's called a beauty fuel reactor, which is now part in partnership with Nexa, which is the conversion of biomass into liquid fuels, synthetic fuels. In other words, it's really, if you want to think of it colloquially, it would be a special plant in a container. That's essentially what it is, but you use biomass as feedstock. Lots of other projects on the transport side. We worked with the Fraunhofer Institute in Germany to develop a model for a diesel electric hybrid bus. And that bus is now under investigation, if you like, for possible use under BRT in Gauteng. So there have been some noteworthy projects that have come through from the Sanyeri side already. On the human capital development side, we set up what we call hubs, the hubs and spokes, and these allow a central university to act as the hub, and then they're supported by various other universities and spokes of the wheel. So we set up two hubs. One was the energy efficiency and demand side management, which is at the University of Pretoria under Professor Shah. It's won a number of awards locally and internationally, and in fact, Victor has established a chair for energy efficiency on the back of the work that's been done by the hub. And we currently have about 151 graduates, postgraduates that are in our program at the moment that will support energy efficiency and ESM rollouts in the future. On renewable energy and sustainable energy, this was established at the University. the kind of everything in energy except nuclear, that's because we had PBMR and the X-ray at the time as the custodians of nuclear research. And then, of course, we set up one of our flagship programs, which is the Center for Carbon Capture and Storage, which we will talk about later. At the same time, we also set up a knowledge management system, which is still very much in its infancy, but the idea behind this is that we need to protect institutional memory. Far too often, we set up programs within government and other public sector institutions, and we don't protect that tacit knowledge. And so part of what we are doing as a knowledge management system is create space for information to be stored and for learning to take place to allow for better utilization of information in the future. A really key component of our work is cooperative research, and we've engaged with a number of international bodies to actually set up joint programs, including Brandenburg Technical University, Brandenburg Technical University in Germany, the UK ERC, which is our equivalent in the UK, the Energy Research Centre in the UK, the US Department of Agriculture that has been actively involved in many areas with us, CSIRO in Australia, that are probably, I would say, the equivalent of our CSIRO to a degree, and the University of Edinburgh, which is also working with us in a number of areas, including smart grids and wave power technology. So just in terms of just a brief overview of our major achievements to date, certainly from a generic perspective, we were fortunate that we had unqualified audit reports from inception through to the transfer to CNEI. Performance scoring system always rated us about 100% that was ordered by the AG. Bursary support program in the space of 2 years, we empowered 70 postgraduates. Some of them are still gainfully employed in the energy sector, although some have moved out internationally or into other areas beyond the energy sector. And then our energy efficiency hub, in the space of 4 years, we empowered 191 graduates, and I mentioned to you that 151 graduates currently registered in our program. Set up together with the Department of Science and Technology, the Green Transport Program. The Green Transport Program was essentially started to showcase energy technologies during the World Cup in 2010. And the idea being to put in place transport solutions that look at different energy propulsion systems. So we look into the compressed natural gas, LPG, biofuels, and electric. And then we also were awarded the hosting rights to host REEF, which is the Renewable Energy Energy Efficiency Partnership, which is based in Austria, but it's an international and multilateral agreement in which various countries are supporting the production of renewable energy and efficiency. We hosted the Secretariat for Southern Africa. We also started the wind mapping exercise, which has now culminated in the production of the wind atlas for South Africa. We're into the second phase of that program at the moment. And then also during Scenery's time, we set up the Working for Energy program, which really follows on the success of the Working for Water program and some of the other Working for programs that are housed under the Expanded Public Works program. So, and David here looks after the Working for Energy program, but we'll talk through some of the highlights so far. There's obviously a lot of work that still has to be done. A tough learning exercise, because one of the things we're trying to find the working for is to create sustainable long-term jobs, which isn't always that easy. Looking at the rural communities and low-income housing areas that are our primary focus for working for energy. If we turn our attention now to Scenery and we consider why, well, first of all, why we needed Scenery, it was clear in the first instance that there was a decline in national energy R&D. In particular in ESCOM, there has been talk, particularly in the mid to late 90s, about possible privatization of ESCOM, which never materialized, but certainly it was corporatized to a degree. And in the process, some of the R&D capacity was lost. At the CSIR, we know that their own energy unit was disbanded. They're trying to resuscitate it, but they did lose critical capacity. And of course, SASOL is very much commercially driven in its R&D and doesn't always necessarily have to share the outcomes of its research programs. We then have to acknowledge, I think, in the course of looking at our R&D capacity, there is a strong linkage between our R&D capacity and our global competitiveness, and you only have to look at South Korea as a primary example of how effective they've been managing that. Also along the way, we need to accept, in line with our white paper on energy of 1998, that South Africa needs to diversify the energy supply. We've been far too dependent upon coal, and even though we support a full thriving coal industry in the country, we need to acknowledge the need for us to diversify into other areas. And of course, there's a controversial aspect around shale gas, but it does provide benefits from the U.S. market, there's every opportunity for South Africa to emulate that, should we be able to overcome the environmental challenges that I think are critical in terms of limiting our potential to take up shale gas. And then also more particularly, we need to look at those technologies that allow us to allow government to reach those communities that are currently marginalized, that have not been able to access the electricity or water sanitation, despite the notable successes that we've achieved in that space since 1994. As a result of those needs, government through the Minister of Energy proposed the National Energy Act, which was then promulgated in 2008. The White Paper on Energy Policy of 1998 helps to create a platform for the introduction of more renewables. And in addition to that, we also have the South African Constitution that looks at the environment, protecting the environment and our role as far as that is concerned. And then there are some specific plans, directives and other announcements that I think also talks to what we need to achieve. And then of course we are guided by the strategic plan of the Department of Energy. We take our two proper departments and we produce our own strategic plan in line with the department's strategic plan. These are some of the key strategies and plans, etc., that we are in line with. The National Energy Efficiency Strategy of 2008, it's actually 2005. The strategy looks at a 12% reduction in final energy demand by 2015, so it's a 10-year strategy. By 2015, we should have a good sense of how effective we have been. What I can tell you up until now is that nobody could tell you how much energy efficiency improvement has been made in the country. No, not even Eskom. The bottom line is that there are so many diverse and disjointed initiatives that are running in the country that it's been very hard for anyone to be able to pin down exactly what has been achieved. Now, the Department of Energy is working with the Swiss government in being able to put together a monitoring evaluation system for this. We're in the process of compiling what we call the Energy Efficiency Database, or NEED, the National Energy Efficiency Database. And that will allow us to consolidate all the information under one umbrella. Then you've got the two master plans that we introduced by the department in 2007, one for liquid fuels, there's still three goals out of our strategic plan. And these three goals talk in essence to what we're trying to achieve. The first one really talks about how do we support high confidence energy planning, decision making and policy development in government. The way to do that is to set up a technical knowledge base. In other words, government can access a database, a learning platform, it can access all the latest statistics analysis that's been done in particular areas around energy, R&D or innovation, and use that to enable its own policy settings. At the same time, we also need to look at supporting accelerated transformation to this less energy and carbon intensive economy that I alluded to earlier. Very importantly, we start looking at how do we transform not only the infrastructure to make it low carbon friendly, but also how do we create jobs in that space. And we're talking about long-term sustainable jobs. We're not talking about sporadic type of casual labor that's been created in some government programs. We're talking about long-term sustainable job creation. Lastly, to look at the rational use of energy, what you could add to that water. They work in tandem in most cases. And here the intention is really to support a further 10% reduction in the short term, where we can actually look at a more energy resource efficient society. That's really the three primary goals. And from those goals, we actually produce programs. And here under those strategic outcomes, we'll see those three goals repeated. Next to them, we'll see our three main programmatic areas that follow on from strategic outcomes. The first one obviously relates to administration management of the entity. The second one relates to our Applied Energy Research and Demonstration Program. Under that program, you've got various sub-programs. And these sub-programs relate to advanced fossil fuel use. That includes carbon capture and storage, as well as shale gas, oil and gas, clean energy solutions, which is where we house our renewable energy for alternative energy solutions, smart grids, where we look at smart metering in addition to systems of the national smart grid itself, green transport sub-program, the working for energy sub-program, and the data and knowledge management. And lastly, our energy efficiency program, which builds on that goal of actually producing a more resource-efficient society. So I'm going to take you through some of the programs briefly, and I'd like to start off with one of our flagship programs, which is our South African Centre for Carbon Capture and Storage, or SACS. We are the host of the centre, and we are sponsors as well, so we're not just hosts, we're also sponsors. There are core parties that are members, including ourselves. We have Statoil, the Norwegian Embassy, and Eskom. Up until last year, the UK government was a core partner as well, but they've withdrawn because they're busy redefining their assistance to various governments, and you've seen that they've withdrawn something from South Africa already. What they have done to compensate, though, is to give a sizable allocation to the World Bank for carbon capture and storage, which has to be dispersed between two countries, ourselves and Mexico. So we're sitting with potentially at least half of £25 million. That's with the World Bank at present. And then we have industry partners. They are participants, and they're receiving. They range from the mostly mining sector players, but we also have Petro SA and Alstom on board as well. So we have a sizable allocation from government, which comes to the Department of Energy for carbon capture and storage. These are the amounts that have been made available over the next 3 years. I'll share with you the progress briefly, but in essence, our goal is by 2017 or 2018 to be injecting carbon dioxide into an underground reservoir. That's the goal. Thereafter, there are some other goals that will follow, but that's your first gatekeeper. If you cannot get the test injection sorted out safely and efficiently, we do not move further. Bearing in mind, there's a lot of international research being done on how do we separate our carbon dioxide where we need to from flue gas in the case of Eskom. If that's what case it don't happen because they have a really pure stream of carbon dioxide. But bearing in mind that there are some challenges in transporting CO2 and actually keeping it underground, those are all the aspects that have to be considered before we can proceed with a commercial scale plant. The £25 million that I've alluded to, that's sitting with the World Bank in the Carbon Capture and Storage Trust Fund. And South Africa is one of the two beneficiaries for that fund. But the Norwegian government has since pledged their commitment to continuing working with us, and of course South African industry continues as well. So in terms of where we are right now, this is the feasibility stage that we're at. We've already produced the storage atlas, so we have an atlas which identifies the onshore and offshore areas where we could potentially store CO2 in South Africa. We at this stage are planning to store CO2 onshore because of the cost implications of going offshore. So here's the current status in terms of where we are. We development framework that we developed. The draft is now in existence. It has now been submitted to the Department of Energy for comment, but it does outline the key areas where we think more R&D is required. On the Shell gas side, we've been requested by National Treasury to work with some of the other departments that have been entrusted with this responsibility. Our goal is really to look at the resource potential and also to look at the environmental aspects linked to the exploitation of shale gas. So that's really what we've been interested in, and hopefully we'll form part of a larger platform looking at how we can safely and environmentally friendly exploit shale gas. Moving on into our Working for Energy program, very important that we consider that in our communities, particularly rural communities, there are opportunities to utilize natural resources, in particular renewable energy sources such as biomass, which could be sourced from waste material, waste wood, from crop waste, and then you also have animal dung that could be available to produce bioenergy. You also have solar and wind potential in a lot of these areas. So for us, it's been really about creating sustainable jobs, particularly green jobs. And in this way, we can contribute to the new growth path. For us, it's not only about creating jobs, but it's also about putting in place a community-driven approach that will ultimately allow for the development of SMEs in those communities and also lead to longer-term sustainability in terms of energy supply or water supply into those areas. The important aspect for us is that in many areas, we have biomass potential, and so we've focused up until now on putting in place a number of bioenergy projects and in particular focusing on utilizing animal dung and converting that to gas or in some cases to electricity. So in the northwest, in Bela Bela, we've converted pig waste into electricity and we're now awaiting a powerful agreement with Eskom to feed that electricity into the grid. In a lot of the other areas, like the western state, we're putting in place biogas digesters in which we're producing gas, and I think in the course of this year, David, we anticipate that we'll complete about 150 digester projects in the future. And I don't think there are too many in the Western Cape. We started with Philippi, and we've now moved over into the Eastern Cape where the need is somewhat greater. So that's really what we're trying to do under the Working for Energy platform. This is just an implementation of one of the projects, and Coneco is a good example. We help construct digesters. We actually teach them how to do that. We teach them how to utilize the gas. Because the gas is a source from animal dung, it's relatively clean. I think we would have serious problems in using human waste for cooking purposes without scrubbing the gas properly. So we tend to focus on using animal dung and any other biomass sources in our digesters. But ultimately, it's about teaching communities how to sustainably utilize this energy source and allow them to be able to demonstrate it and also to build up an industry, a small industry, around those types of technologies. We're also heavily involved in schools greening at the moment, working in Kimberley and other areas of the country, where we're also allowing schools to now go off-grid as much as possible, and where biomass permits also to introduce digesters to give them gas for cooking at school, as well as in some cases for space heating as well. So that's an important aspect which David is looking at. I must point out to you that we are in the process of establishing a model for what we call the Waste Energy Hub. We were planning to start the hub at Inkomash in KZN. Unfortunately, Itikini Metro has decided to first appoint a transaction advisor to determine how best to smart grids. And the reason why this is so important is twofold as well. First of all, the national grid is dated. It was set up by Eskom for a particular purpose. It really talks to taking power and supplying it to a customer, where the customer has very little in terms of power to actually intervene in terms of choice. At the same time, we also have to recognize that we're now introducing power from renewable energy sources. In some cases, the power is intermittent. Our national grid was not established to handle power, which is intermittent. So we need to revamp an overall national grid in mind. Obviously, you don't revamp the whole grid in one go. You start off somewhere, and in doing that, you set in place a vision, and that vision document has now been produced. Obviously, from there, we'll be looking at the gaps in terms of what is currently missing in our grid, and then starting off somewhere. Now, the way we started this process is by looking at the smart meter area, because of the residential side, lots of metros are looking at introducing smart meters. And there are many benefits for being smart meters, but one of them has got to be increased or improved value. Second of all, from the consumer perspective, a better awareness of what is happening in terms of your power consumption, how do I control it as a consumer. To that concept, we like to add the e-learning concept, which we share with people for the promotion of energy, and there's a lot of favorable support for that. The intention behind that is that when we go into rural areas, you can still do a smart grid. We call a micro smart grid because of the area size. And what we would do is we would look at making available the smart meter plus a tablet. Now, already housing and problems is looking at spending about $2.2 billion on e-learning inside of the problems, and we'll be looking at a scaled-down version of that, in which we provide a tablet into the household, and the household will then be able to access information from the smart meter. The learner will be able to use the tablet at school, because we'll be able to, the same channel, using the power and carrier, for instance, to be able to transfer technology onto the tablet in terms of their textbooks. We'll also be able to do web-based classes, so we could run classes in Bryanston or here in Cape Town and actually have those classes being made available in the Eastern Cape. They can save the classes, so they can replay them when they want to at home, and they'll also be able to actually save all past papers, get tutorials and everything done internationally, and all that will be stored on the tablet. So for us, it's a great way of actually improving the awareness around energy and at the same time stimulating the interest in science and technology at the learner level, in particular in high school. So, for us, it's a phenomenal program. The Department of Energy is working together with the EU in supporting this particular exercise. There's an EU-funded program, which is about 180 million, which we've been able to source from the EU and which we'll be using for a smart meter pilot together with the Department of Energy. But obviously, we would like to make sure that we introduce the whole notion of e-learning at the same time, because it benefits the community, first in understanding your energy consumption, but also more particularly being able to get our learners to be able to have access to a high quality, world-class education system. And if you look at the recent textbook fiasco, certainly it should be cheaper for us to provide learners with tablets. We're looking at tablets that could be manufactured in South Africa ultimately. Kenya and India are good examples that have done it, and they've produced tablets for about 300 rand. Be a phenomenal target for us to achieve as well. If you can do that, it would be a lot cheaper than providing them with textbooks, and if they go missing, which is most likely going to happen in some cases, it should be relatively straightforward to replace them at that cost. And so for us, this is a very important project, and as I said, working together with the Department of Energy, but we'd also like to include the Department of Basic Education in being able to drive this process in rural areas in particular. And on the data knowledge management side, we're in the process of developing an integrated data repository. We've already started with solar water heaters. So, generally speaking, everywhere where a solar water heater has been installed under a government program, we now have access to that on a GIS-based system. So we could see your house, we could see your ID number and everything else that you maybe not want us to know. But the bottom line is that we're now able to drill down and see exactly what's happening at the household level. Similarly, for energy efficiency, this is what we're busy with now, and under the tax incentive program, and I'd like to leave you with these copies later, but this is the review of what's being done under Section 12I of the Income Tax Act that looks at providing an energy efficiency incentive, and this is a summary of the program so far. But certainly it's important that together with the monitoring and evaluation project of the DOE, that we have a consolidated database that looks at all energy efficiency as well. the technology management information center, which really acts as a portal, storing that information, making it available to the public, is certainly a requirement, and we're busy with that now. We're also in the process of reviewing the direction for our center called CESA, which is our Center for Energy Systems Analysis and Research. The motivation behind CESA is that the department is involved in various planning activities, as well as the Department of Science and Technology. And in order to undertake planning or policy-related activities, one needs access to human resources, and it needs access to tools. And so CESA does that. It also generates its own studies in terms of analyzing various systems. One may ask what kind of systems would one look at. Well, for instance, under the Renewable Energy ICT program, in which renewable energies are being introduced into the grid, over a period of a year or two, one would need to assess how successful we have been. CESA creates the opportunity to analyze that system and determine how successful we have been in implementation so far. And from there, government can decide how best to redirect the program to make it more effective if necessary. And then lastly, very importantly, is the need to improve access to information. And this is for the public, as well as for governments and everybody else that's involved in the space. And then onto our green transport program. We've had some notable successes so far. We worked with the industry during the 2010 World Cup. We actually have implemented a number of minibus taxis in the course of the past couple of years to run on hybrid solution, which is LPG and petrol. Very interesting to see that the payback period is just under 1 year for a minibus taxi, which is phenomenal. And they're very happy with the concept, so they will be rolling it out themselves. The principle is quite simple. You have a separate storage tank for gas, which is mounted in the rear of the vehicle. It doesn't impact at all in terms of the occupancy limits. From a safety perspective, gas is as safe as a petrol tank. Importantly, there's a seamless switch between gas and petrol, so you don't even have to do anything yourself. The system switches between the two. Run out of gas, you switch over to petrol. So far we've had some very good success in that regard, also with natural gas, where we retrofitted a number of government buses in Gauteng, and we set in place a refueling plant, also in Johannesburg, to allow buses to be refueled with compressed natural gas. Compressed natural gas is sourced from Egoli gas, which in turn gets it from Sasol. So there is a bigger plan in place in Gauteng now to improve access to gas. When that does happen, of course, we'll need to inform more of these buses on the road at present. We're also putting in place, as you'll see from the slide, what we call a soft start facility. This is for small companies that are eager to participate in the green transport space. And bearing in mind, the majority of the work is being done by your large OEMs or motor manufacturers. But there's quite a sizable percentage of small companies out there that want to get into the space, and they want to provide various services. For instance, they want to provide biofuels. So for them to provide biofuel, they need some kind of incentive, or they need some kind of infrastructure in place. This is where Finelli will be assisting them. We're already working with the equipment manufacturers on the electric vehicle. The intention is to support the introduction of public charging facilities for electric vehicles, and then we'll be looking at the billing system that goes with public charging of electric vehicles. It's very important because this LEAP will be launched during the course of this year officially into the market, and then of course next year BMW launches their own electric vehicle. There will be some others that will follow fairly shortly. So a lot of work has been done already. We'd also like to work in various precincts around Johannesburg in particular, where we're trying to create car-free zones. And there's a precinct called Mabone. We'll be looking at doing that. It's near Ellis Park. And the idea is that we will restrict access to conventional powered vehicles in support of getting cleaner vehicle technologies into that space. There's a lot of work that's been done at present around green transport, and the work in support of the provincial transport department. This program will really start to deliver more and more over and above what is done in the taxi industry and the private sector already. And then on to renewable energy technologies. On our renewable energy side again, we've got our renewable energy center called VECOR. This is a partnership with the universities in the country. Under that umbrella, we're involved in developing new solutions with the universities. It helps them to have a coordinated approach, because ultimately you find that too many academics have got big projects of their own, and they don't have a consolidated, coordinated view or anything. We've been been involved in quite a few projects already, including the wind atlas for South Africa called WATRA, which is supported by the Danish government, but involved CSIR as well as the Weather Bureau and a couple of others, and weather services are involved. We're also developing a mobile waste to energy plant, which is this beauty fuel reactor, household biofuel, together with Nelson Mandela Metro University. They are the ones that have been instrumental in setting up an algae plantation that you can actually use to produce biofuels. Huh? But also the nice thing that you can do with algae is you can actually take out carbon dioxide by feeding it to the algae. The algae grows very quickly, so you actually absorb a lot of CO2 and you can produce liquid fuels, or you can actually burn the algae if you choose to. We also produced a solar roadmap, well, we're in the process of doing that with the Department of Energy. This is also in conjunction with the Department of Science and Technology. And we've also been working with the private sector in developing energy efficient hubs. There's a number of initiatives like this, but what we ultimately seek to do here is to take what we already started and translate that into also a knowledge management system so that developers out there can get a sense of what constitutes an energy efficient house. Because there are so many different building materials out there, and ultimately it comes down to a trade-off between cost and efficiency. You can do everything you want to, you can insulate the straw with glass, with wood, with whatever you want to, but ultimately it comes to the price. We're also supporting the solar park, which is a concept driven by the former Minister of Energy and supported by the Department of Energy as well as TEP. Our support to the solar park would be in the form of a tested meteorological station. So once the sites are finalized, we'll be working with the department and putting that together so that the technology providers have access to that information and will also be able to test the equipment in a space which is similar to where they would be commercially operating their technology. Then lastly, we're working very heavily with the international community, and I'll share with you briefly later what type of linkages we have to those international bodies, but certainly our objective right now is to maximize our access to available international research, because ultimately we can't reproduce everything in duplicate, so we'd rather learn from our partners abroad and introduce best practice in South Africa. On to energy efficiency. I already alluded to the Income Tax Amendment Act, which looks at applying a tax incentive or rebate to industry for energy efficiency improvements, and the report is here that I'll circulate. We've also, as I mentioned earlier, also set up the Energy Efficiency and Demand Side Hub, Management Hub at the University of Pretoria. We're now in the process of converting that into a centre, so that it will be conducting more and more of its own contract R&D over and above the postgraduate support that it's been offering so far. We currently support industry and also the banks through what we call the Technical Advisory Facility that is supported by the French Development Agency. We're also supposed to play the role of a national champion for energy efficiency in as far as awareness raising is concerned, and this is where we're working with various entities that also have a responsibility in the space. And in my last few slides, talks to the problems that one experiences in trying to manage this role when you have so many other entities operating in the same space. And then lastly, a very important one, which is the requirement from the Department of Energy that there be a national MND or Measurement and Verification Center. This has to be established in light of the fact that we have the Income Tax Amendment Act, which calls for measurement and verification to be done. We currently have a very limited number of practitioners. We have to be certificated to undertake this role. And in order to get that certification, you have to go through a training program first. So we're trying to enhance the training first in a secondary grade one center, and then the private sector can access that energy capacity coming out of that particular center. We've also been working on the labeling system, which you'll see in the diagram on your right, in terms of the EU label, which we've adopted for energy efficiency. The Department of Energy is tasked with introducing appliance labeling. There's a private sector partner that's also working on this. But ultimately, we've started this program some time ago, probably in about 2005, and we're still awaiting the final label on a number of products, over and above refrigerators, which is where the program started. And then also, now, this is on the solar water heater monitoring system that I mentioned to you earlier. This is supported by GIZ from the Germans, and we now have a GIS, or Geographical Information System. And on that, we've got this, what we call the ArcGIS suite of products that allows us now to capture all the relevant information about solar water heaters and to put that onto a single board. But later on, we'll be able to use that information for various other planning exercises. The system was demonstrated to the former Minister of Energy mitigate greenhouse gases is where we looked at carbon capture and storage, and at EVCAN, which is our smart grid implementing agreement. So this is just a sample. There are others on the clean coal side of which we participate in, and the solar phases, which is looking at large-scale solar, which Eskom looks after. There's also the 4E one, which is energy efficiency. And that one is also managed between ourselves and Eskom. So we have a number of strategic relationships with the IEA, and we support this together with the department. Now, I know most people don't like acronyms, I'm afraid, so I'm happy to take it to them. I apologize if they're always acronyms and anything, but maybe just to highlight to you, and I'll start with the FP7. This is the some of the international linkages and local linkages that Canadi has, which helps us to fulfill our mandate. FP7 is our framework program 7 under the European Commission. It's an R&D funding mechanism under the EU. Here, of course, everybody knows domestically, on the technology innovation side, CSR, ESCOM, is all local. On the EU side, there are a number of programs that are funded by the EU directly, including the Smart Meter program. Various universities, both locally and internationally, I've mentioned Edinburgh, but there's Strathclyde, there's Imperial College of London, there's Brandenburg in Germany, and there's a whole range of universities that we actually partner with so we can actually maximize the return on investment for South African taxpayers. SDC on the Swiss development side, that's where the monitoring and evaluation project is housed. GIZ on the German side, they're funding what is called SAGEN, the South African German Energy Program. They look at supporting renewable energies as well as energy efficiency. AFD, the French Development Agency, supporting primarily energy efficiency, but they will be looking at supporting other areas as well. And then last, of course, the IEC, we're looking at partnering with them on the commercial pilot. So it's a snapshot, again, as I said to you, there are many other bodies. We're different on the UK side, we're working with different, we're working with US TDA on the US side. The Dutch government, there's just too many of them, but this is a snapshot of where the international linkages. I'm coming to the end of the presentation, we've got a lot, 4 or 5 slides. Of importance to us, as for any state entity, is issues around funding. And so, one has to consider in the context of such a broad mandate, our remit is so large, we cover everything but nuclear. It's inevitable that you will always have funding constraints, because you cannot do everything. But in essence, we have to talk about some of the funding constraints. We have an HR issue in terms of resources. Bearing in mind, I'll give you the numbers that make up to me, complements your CY. And then also lastly, just the energy efficiency mandate, given the fact that you have so many different players operating in the same space. Now, in terms of funding, some of our key programs are awaiting further funding, in particular the green transport program. I've mentioned the success of the past. As a result of those successes, the Department of Transport committed 10 million rand per year for 3 years for the green transport program. They subsequently did a reprioritization last year, and we're not able to make those funds available. They've just indicated to us now that they might be in a position to make those funds available, and we will wait for further communication from them in that regard. But there are other entities out there that will also benefit from this, so we haven't restricted ourselves to transport. We're not looking at other entities that can support it as well. Our Working for Energy program received 45 million rand over 3 years from Treasury. That's kind of has come to an end at the end of last year. In fact, it was probably the previous year. We've carried over 25 million rand of our funds in order for us to complete the pilot project that has been started. I think it's important to understand the way in which Working for Energy operates. We establish pilots so that we can actually test technology and see if it's suitable. If the technology is suitable, we look at the crafting, the training around it, and then we look at the business case that will follow it. A classic example is what we did in Havelmere with the solar project that was launched during COP17 in Durban. Is that a technology provider provided the technology, which is concentrated photovoltaic energy, it's a form of PV that's concentrated. And we provided the training that was required to allow for installation and maintenance of those systems. From there, we developed a commercial model in terms of how that could be rolled out in rural areas as the next step to that whole process. That is an example of how this works. Energy efficiency, there's always a challenge because there are a number of programs in particular public buildings that supply funding. Treasury has made funding available under DORA for public buildings that are no funds that come to an end. And we need to determine together with EFRAM, what is the future of energy efficiency and DSM funding as ideally we'd like to keep all of them, but that might not necessarily be possible. I think bearing in mind that Synergy is intended to be a technology management function, so we're not necessarily designed to undertake R&D in-house, because we have R&D bodies at universities and CSR and everywhere else. We're not being duplicated. In some cases, like carbon capture storage, we'll be setting up our own operation. In green chance, we'll be setting up our own operation. But everything else, like renewables, energy efficiency, everything else, will all be managed at facilities that we establish at the university. So those academics are funded exclusively by Synergy, so they actually become staff members. But we leave them at universities because we like to make sure that they continue with their teaching responsibilities as well. So we are looking at other sources of funding for interns, but at the same time we also have to build up our staff complement to about 66. And I think once we are 66, we'll probably have sufficient capacity to manage not only the design of programs, which is our core competency, but also to project manage some of the more critical ones ourselves. So that's really what we're trying to reach, that the organization is as streamlined as possible. So we are talking to the Department of Energy now about accessing additional funding to NTF. Also, we're in this process of moving away from SEF and CHEA. I didn't allude to earlier the fact that we are a separate from SEF, even though we share support services with SEF. And that creates a problem, because SEF is a different kind of entity to us. They're a Schedule 2 entity, we're Schedule 3A. Schedule 3A is a different financial management supporting systems that are required. They are under GRAP, under GAP, we are under GRAP. Their procurement system is different slightly to ours, so we have all kinds of challenges in being able to manage our system independently. And just on the energy efficiency side, as I mentioned to you earlier, NASA would like to see that ESCOM perhaps not be entrusted with the responsibility of introducing energy efficiency, because there is an issue around conflict of interest. ESCOM should ultimately be selling electricity, not saving electricity at some point in the future. But similarly, the department might feel that Synergy should not be a funder as well as an implementer as well of energy efficiency. But in itself, you have various entities that are involved in this space. You have 49M, which ESCOM is funding, but it's also a national initiative. ESCOM itself, other integrated demand management, local authorities, power lead feature, etc., all ESCOM driven. And then you've got the research space, where you've got DSG, ESCOM, and others operating in the National Senior Production Center and so on. And then you get different messages. I mean, for instance, today, nobody can tell you definitively what's better for your household, a solar water heater or a heat pump. It just depends on the geographic conditions, climatic conditions, that will determine your, and of course, occupancy levels and utilization factors. And then you've got compact fluorescent lights or LEDs, which are better. We know LEDs are better, but they're not cheaper. So there's all kinds of conflicting messages that I see in the public at present, and this is really what we need to safeguard against. So what we decided to do is in conjunction with the Department of Energy to produce a position paper which really talks to the Synergy's role, and that involves a clearinghouse facility. And this clearinghouse helps to ensure proper integration and coordination by being able to divide the programs, and once the programs are designed, they'll be left up to the energy service companies and others to actually implement. But certainly Synergy would be entrusted with that responsibility to design these programs. Also, because we have an independent performance tracking role in as far as income tax amendment is concerned, we need to make sure that we maintain our independence in this regard. And then, of course, to compile this central repository of energy efficiency data, which we've already started under this new database. And then also, lastly, and very importantly, is for us to cater for this alignment integration of donor funds to make sure that we have one consolidated program that looks at enhancing energy efficiency improvements in the country. On the other side, what we're doing inside of Synergy as well is that we're trying to work more and more with local and international funders to enhance what we receive from Treasury. We receive a base allocation of just over 50 million. That we can add the 6 million from DSG, and then we have the sizable allocation of about 200 million over 3 years for carbon capture and storage. And we also had 180 million over 3 years for smart meters. So the funding is coming, but it's a case of the right projects still need to be supported. A variable costing model allows us to be able to apportion costs to the right programs, and it's important when the donors start looking at exactly what they've contributed in the day that they've got out of their projects. Also, being able to optimize our interaction with our sister organizations in the energy space or innovation space, by making use of the confidence and mutual skills development. And then lastly, to make sure that
The there's a lot of developments already. There's another term that's been used in the Northern Cape that might also create confusion, that's the one about the solar corridor. What is the difference between the solar corridor and the solar park? Of course, with all the development there, certainly there's this much clarity in terms of what that means. Then, the last issue, Jay, is there's a lot of reference to the various universities, specifically Stellenbosch, Nelson Mandela, Victoria. But according to the research unit, 80 or more than 80% of the support for bursaries go to the University of Pretoria. Now, if you know the type of work that they're doing in Stellenbosch and with other universities, you know it's also high quality work and research. What is the reason for the fact that 80% of that goes to the University of Pretoria? Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this presentation. In fact, if you look at the fact that you're sitting with a manpower of 11 people and the work that they are saying and doing, it's very impressive. In fact, if all government departments would be so efficient, we would have a country spinning in economic development. So, we were promised two reports from you, which I hope we'll get. South Africa's energy self-sufficiency is, I think there's a report out on that. And if I'm not mistaken, it's in front of cabinet or something like that. Can we have a copy of it? Is it available? And then there was another one that crossed my mind, but it's just maybe it'll come up later or come back later. Wave power technology is something that we often get inquiries on, and then we are being told that the technology has not developed. Is it so far that we can implement it? Because there's certainly a sufficient current around our first line to develop this, and how does that compare in cost? I think all your other programs are very interesting. The SAFL program, did you have a share in that gas to petroleum project that they just built? Is that the only one that's going to be done, or are there more and bigger ones coming? And is that what you have in mind for the land, Johannesburg, Gauteng? When you talk about the bio waste digester project, you know, I'm very concerned. When I look at the thing, it seems like such a big system that it almost looks cumbersome. What is the unit cost of such a thing? Because we need to compare that with areas where there is no water. You were talking about the outlying areas, getting electricity to the outlying areas. And in very many cases, kids must still go downhill with a donkey with the two ponkas to go and fetch water. So can this be done in those areas? Point number one. Point number two, are we getting to a level that we can produce those things so economically that we can do a whole township with them and still come out cheaper than having the cost of water-based toilets, if you understand what I mean, with a whole system. In other words, I'm talking about the unit and its cost effectivity in comparison to the current water system that we have. Your oil and gas framework I'm really interested in. Your shale gas research, is that a public document or where is it at this stage? When you were talking, just to go back to the toilet, we have so many facility for children. And I was wondering whether you know anything about that for the department. And I don't care if that particular university doesn't want, or that particular city does not want you there. I promise you we will have you in Kauka any day. Mm-hmm. And we will do it there. So just come to Human Talk and Jeffrey Bay and we will put it up for you. I also see that you've actually just spoken to KZN and the Eastern Cape on other projects. Is that just because there was a gap and you have got researchers in that area, or are you covering the whole area? And then when it comes to electricity for the outlying areas, you know, I mentioned it before, the Noordkraal school in Kaukama, they're building an 18-kilometer power line for that school. And it's a 22 kV power line and not just an ordinary, what we would call a swear line, from the one school to the next. Nobody else taps off that line. A solar system would have cost that school far less, like 100,000 rand and not, say, 18 million, because if you work it at a million rand per kilometer. How does one stop such a thing and bring in the cost effectivity of that? Smart grid. Well, Elizabeth is now, the Nelson Mandela Center is now into a smart grid system, and they claim they're the first city into the smart grid system. Then we went to East London last week and we asked, now what is happening in Buffalo City? And nothing seems to be happening in Buffalo City. And this morning when I asked, now have you changed all your bulbs in the city? Is there a system that you measure this department and that department to see which ones are using the most electricity and are cost effective? And yes, they are apparently studying it, but you know there's no system installed to control it. Streetlights. We do realize that streetlights are very expensive to replace because it's new technology and so on, but if you do that bit by bit per annum, you can work out a plan to replace that over, say, 5 years, and it shouldn't cost you too much. But how many of our other cities are actually close to being smart grid cities? Because once we've got the smart grid cities going, then at least we can get the ordinary municipalities to follow. Because I don't know if the smart grid system will make up for the electricity theft in the country. And do you have a plan to stop the electricity theft, or counter the electricity theft, or illegal electricity connections, or whatever you want to call it? And I think when it comes to the cars, I thought this new BMW was what the i3 is, the car that you were referring to here. You said it's coming next year. So it's been launched now, but it's only in production next year, if I understood you correctly. No. Well, and the car-free zones puzzle me, because I think you must explain a little bit more how that works. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Yes, thank you to Sunil also for the interesting presentation. I'd like to know on the jobs you're creating, the BioMed program, are you doing all the provinces, or is it just the rural areas or just certain provinces? And then very interesting to the school greening project, the same question, is it for all the provinces, because we've got all schools in our provinces and we'd also like to benefit. The smart meter pilot e-learning, interesting. Also, in which provinces will this be rolled out? And now the rural areas need it a lot, but I've also got the rural areas in Gauteng. And then the conference national guests, that is happening in Gauteng, but the buses, will there be conversion of the buses? And what is the cost involved in the assessment? And interestingly, car free zones also in Gauteng, Ellis Park. Ellis Park is a huge area, very populated area. If you're going to roll it out there, what will happen to just the surrounding areas, the pollution? Because Ellis Park is so compressed. Why did you choose Ellis Park, and how would you actually eliminate the other populations and population and everything that's in there? Ellis Park is very condensed.
competition is the concept. I'll start with the job. That's a matter of interest. It's just one time party in Parliament. It's a showcase. What was really the problem with the job? Some thinkers, when they're sitting under the tree, they say, maybe we should have called it Mandela. And maybe we should have moved. And nobody would have questioned it. But other people are saying, why do you rely on foreign donors? Because I think that was the reason, you can correct me, of foreign funders, why you're not moving forward, investors with the children. Why can't we do that in South Africa as a country? With a lot of research institutions that we have and the car now at our doorstep, why do we rely on the foreign investors? Another problem with that is that other people say, whoever pays the piper, plays the tune. Now that goes with all the other questions on your research. The UK, US, Andenberg, everybody, most of your funding comes from foreigners. So they actually pay the piper. And we then bank according to what they say to the funding. On that particular note, who holds the intellectual property? The research you do with a foreign institution, who holds the ownership? You might say it's their money that was used, so they hold, just like Bafana Bafana. We find ourselves not owning Bafana Bafana, so we find ourselves not owning these things. Are you meeting your establishment reasons? You know, when some people say it and say, let us establish the name because of 1, 2, 5, 9, 10. Are you meeting those reasons? If you do a review, should you still continue? Are you having a knock on those reasons why you are established? Now, if you could just, in a short space of time, just blow by blow, tell us the progress on shake. Whether it is medium term or long term. On your 2012, 2013, 16 and 17 strategic plan, you propose for the establishment of the National Energy Fund. That will support research and technology innovation. How far is the process? Doing that. I'm trying to keep some of the questions that have been asked. Okay, I'll stop the chat. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just one important question, Honorable Hamele. I haven't noticed or heard that the presenter mentioned the people with disabilities. Do you have any of your staff compliments? If yes, what is their position? If no, why not? Thank you.
The LED bulbs are so expensive. Is there any research into making it economically more friendly to install? Thank you.
Thank you so much. There are just one or two questions here that I'm going to have to defer to the department here on my team at the solar box. So, and then also with your indulgence, at an appropriate time, if I could just ask for one signal of indulgence to allow my colleague David, just to perhaps just show you a couple of pictures from the digesters, because there was a question about scale size. theory studies around how to best establish Sunedi over a period of time. Bearing in mind that we always understand that there are always funding constraints in government. That is the nature of government communication. We always have funding issues that need to be addressed. So that is why we propose various strategies. And what we determine is that if there is going to be a compromise in terms of funding, one has to understand that it comes at the cost of certain political, and at the same time it also comes at the cost of rapid independence away from SETI. So we've always understood, we always believe that Treasury understood that if they weren't able to meet the funding requirements, then it would have implications in as far as our dependence from SETI would be concerned. So that has been the reality. When we received the funding allocation, which is the 200 million over 2 years that was originally proposed, then we had to amend business case to reflect exactly what we deliver for that. So it talks to a later question, which is that are we meeting that expectation? Well, the short answer will be no, because you have to make do with what you have. What we've decided to do, and particularly in the course of this year, is to prioritize not only those key deliverables that we know are going to add value in a very, very short period of time. Now, R&D by nature is not short term. You cannot show results overnight from R&D. We shouldn't expect that. But at the same time, Sunedi is now also a development institute. It's not an R&D-based institution anymore. Its goal is to transform industry in support of a low-carbon future, which means that there has to be results, there has to be deliverables in a short enough period of time. This is where our focus has changed somewhat. But we cannot lose sight of the bigger goal, which is that we have to improve South Africa's competitiveness. And how are we going to do that? If we want generating local R&D that's going to allow South Africa to be competing on international platforms. And this is where that solar Johanna or simple solar technology at University of Johannesburg is so critical, because if we can't get that into the marketplace, well, then we set up this system. Because there's no way that we can do anything else if we can't get that simple solar technology into the marketplace. And I'll talk about the jewel later, because it had a different challenge to it. But the solar technology that we developed at UJ is cost competitive already with anything in the marketplace. And it will only get cheaper in relation to the rest of the market. So it has to be supported at that level. Yes, in terms of our staff numbers, we have 11 permanent staff members, but the rest of us are all on contracts. So we are all at 5-year contracts, which is the way business works in most cases, and keeps them on at the end of the day. So this is the reality of it. So we have 40 staff members, but they're all committed in terms of 5 years at least. I think bearing in mind also that we sit with NPF allocation, it's hard to really look at making people permanent unless we've got some certainty beyond what the NPF provides for. So this is really what we're trying to deal with, that when we do get additional funding in, because this is what we try and do, we try and get funding in from projects. We're not there yet because some of these projects are still being developed, but once those projects are running, they'll create a funding, a revenue source, which can sustain permanent positions over and above what's currently on the card at present. So yes, it is very frustrating in terms of looking at the current financial environment. There's so much needs to be done, but like I said to you now, we also need to consolidate and do what the Department of Energy believes also is more pressing and urgent requirements to meet those requirements in the short term. The electric vehicle, let's talk about the Juul very briefly. When the Juul was conceptualized, it had a niche window. There was a gap in the marketplace to develop an electric vehicle. Why? Because a lot of the original equipment manufacturers in Europe and Japan and everywhere else in the States, it took a very long time to settle on a model for an electric vehicle, and that created a space, a limited space. But with the rising fuel price, as well as the introduction of more efficient battery technology, which is a huge constraint for electric vehicles, your battery technology is ultimately what governs how effective your vehicle is. Because if you have a range of 200 kilometers, the EFT5, am I happy with a vehicle like that? You will never get 400 or 500 kilometers of an electric vehicle. But at the same time, those batteries come at a cost. And ultimately, you have to replace those batteries maybe every 3 or 4 years. And that's going to set you back anything between 60,000 to 150,000 rand, depending on which car you've got. So the latest lithium-ion polymer, lithium-ion batteries, they have to be replaced maybe every 4 years. That cost has to be factored in. This is why some manufacturers are now looking at leasing the batteries out rather than actually having the vehicle with the battery stock that it needs. The problem with the Juul is that you move from a stage where you can produce 8 prototypes, which is what the Juul did. So they have 8 prototypes running around. It's fantastic. They're very expensive, and you can spend about R1 million per vehicle to manufacture them, and that's great. They look good and they'll work fantastically. But when you have to put them onto a production line, then the cost drops to, let's say, R15 billion. And when you start looking at costs like that, then you have to start saying, well, who's going to fund this? And that is why the get up to the, I think in particular the interfaith development community to also support this. And unfortunately nobody had an appetite for this because the cost keeps on escalating. I thought you'd maybe look at possibly even 150 billion, depending on what size industry you're looking for. And so the investors became very wary of competing in a space where you have to sell 50,000 vehicles per annum. Now, to sell 50,000 vehicles, you're not selling in South Africa, the electric vehicle market is very small. Selling internationally, you're now competing against the BMWs, the Nissans, the Peugeots, and maybe the Renaults, who all have electric vehicles. Now, in South Africa, you can get away by calling it the Mandela. You're going to get people to probably buy it, yes. You're not going to get away with that in Europe. The bottom line is that people are driven by brand, they're driven by reliability, and they're driven by after-sales service. If you don't have that in place, you're not going to buy your vehicle. Even in South Africa, the guy, if you give them the BMW or a Jewel, they're going to buy the BMW. Even if the BMW is 10% more expensive, they're going to buy the BMW. That's unfortunately how things work. So this is why it didn't make sense to invest to continue when there wasn't any certainty that you could sell 50,000 vehicles per annum. Then they decided to change the model and said, well, let's park the concept of the vehicle on the car and let's focus on the bus. Because they still didn't need sold in South Africa for a bus. But to hinge your whole commercial model around selling a few buses, that also didn't make sense to invest. And this is why they decided to pull the plug, because there isn't a compelling enough commercial case that can be made for the dual aspect. And that situation will remain. The best way that they should have approached, in my humble opinion, is they're partnering with BMW or Mercedes right up front. And then they develop the jewel under that umbrella, right? That's one. Rather than for a wholly South African brand, go with an international presence, get it up and running, and then you can look at what is South Africa's stake in it. And you can, over time, you can buy a bigger stake in your own project at the end of the day. So that would have been the approach we should have taken, but in hindsight, it's always 20-20 vision, I guess. Perhaps, I don't know if I could ask my colleague Mukhari, maybe just a comment on the solar farm.
Moved in terms of preventing those issues. There is a second site that has already in the pre-supply, we have already completed the geotechnical study. We are in the process of environmental impact assessment as well as the main feasibility study. And the main feasibility study is looking at the whole proposed 5,000 megawatts. So each site, the Arkansas as well as the Pisca, we hoping to generate 1,000 megawatts at each site. Because of the limited resources that are there, we couldn't look at all the six sites that were proposed initially. That would be taken gradually in terms of completing the project. And on the Arkansas side, the tenders as well have been completed in terms of looking at the geotechnical, the environmental impact assessment, and the detailed feasibility study as well. So we're hoping that towards the end of this financial year, we should be presenting the results of the two sites seeking for further consideration. So that's the progress in terms of the solar park. And maybe just to add before Kevin continues on the waste energy, there are some engagements in terms of the government of South Africa through the Department of Energy and the Scottish government in terms of exploring more possibilities for the waste in the Scottish government. They have done like extensive studies and even implementing the project in that respect. So hence we try to partner and explore the possibility of extending or implementing such within our context. So those would be the two questions that I would respond to.
Thanks very much. If I can just continue. Some of the questions that followed, one of them was on the issue of universities and the support that we provide to universities. In the beginning, certainly in the early days, we opened it up to everybody. In fact, when we established the hubs, we actually advertised the hubs nationally, and we had responses from all the universities that were interested. Stellenbosch University, for instance, was the most keen for the new energy one, together with UCT. Those two came out the bid and were evaluated by DST and ourselves, and Stellenbosch won the bid. On the energy efficiency side, we had about two or three universities that applied to host energy efficiency, and the University of Pretoria was successful. But some of the other chairs that were established were, in fact, more into University of Stellenbosch, because our biofuels chair went to the property move and fell in Stellenbosch University, and then Dr. Rosemary Falcon of Ritz University was offered the Clean Coal Technologies chair. And then we have an associate chair at Northwest University for biofuels, it was Professor Simon Mark. And so then we advertised for other chairs, including the domestic fuels. And the uptake was very poor. A lot of universities are not too involved with domestic fuels. We're now in the process of trying to establish a rural energy research facility at Walter Sisulu University in Mthatha. Unfortunately, the university is not in a position at the moment to support us in that regard, so we're having a tough time in trying to get them to work with us. We've also supported Nelson Mandela in a number of initiatives and many project-related activities, and we're now looking at partnering with them on electric vehicles, and even the dual vehicles. So we're going to be working with them in that regard. So certainly, the way things work out now is that because our bursary support program was taken over by DSD, a lot of universities have been funded by us, are now being funded by DSD. What's left is some of the programs that we initiated ourselves. This is why you see a potentially bias towards the University of Pretoria, because the bulk of our funds went into a single program, and unfortunately all is limited by the University of Pretoria. But the idea is to work with all of them. We have research projects with 4GA as well. And in fact, David can even talk about it, because we're currently working with 4GA on the biogas side, for instance, for working for energy. In terms of reports, and I'll move on to the next question. In terms of reports, from an energy self-sufficiency perspective, I think maybe honorable members bring into the integrated energy plan, because that draft is out for comments. We would have to make arrangements to send it to the department. I think there is a comes to officially ask our colleagues if that could be arranged. The wave power technology. There are various types of technology, and I think with the indulgence of the chair, I'll just mention to you briefly the different types of technologies that are out there. You get tidal technologies, you get ocean current technologies, and you get wave power technologies, and they're all different. South Africa doesn't have a fantastic tidal resource, so we can discard tidal technologies completely at this stage. In terms of ocean current technologies, we have always another one, which is looking at ocean thermal energy differences as well. If you look at the normal current ones, we have the Agassiz current, which ESCOM are very interested in exploiting. Unfortunately, the first thing is around ESCOM's interest in how to exploit that resource. The typical way of doing it is in the form of wind turbine technologies, which are actually submerged. That's really what they look like. And then they generate power underwater. The area where there's so much happening is in wave power technologies, too. There's so many different variants out there. So that's what I was looking at, something called Palau Wave Strength, the red one. That's been demonstrated in Portugal, but they haven't established a proper commercial case for it as yet. So there are numerous types of technologies out there. The problem is the technologies are not mature enough commercially to warrant widespread utilization. Stellenbosch University, of course, developed the SWEC, the Stellenbosch Wave Energy Converter. And they have a second generation of the Wave Energy Converter that they were proposing for development. But we were actually looking at the area just off Long Island as a possible site for this. But obviously, you need to have approval from the infrastructure authorities as well as funding for a small pilot. If that is the role, it is definitely a potential. There's no question that South African coastline, particularly in the winter months, has a significant wave potential. So it's still very much a part of our focus. The way we approach it is to stay in touch with the international community, working with EMEC, which is the European Marine Energy Center, and they are probably the world leading experts at the moment in terms of exploitation of wave energy. So in Scotland, we've got a hydro research facility and a wave research facility as well. So we're looking at partnering with them. We are partnering with them and with the IEA, the Ocean Energy System Technology Agreement. And as the new technology matures to the point that it becomes commercially viable, we'll be taking that approach certainly. In terms of SASL, SIF has been working with SASL in particular EGAS, where EGAS has been a partner to own 25% of the pipeline, the Longco project, which is from SASL to Secunda. From there, SASL would like to expand the infrastructure into Gauteng. We would like that because it supports our goal on the transport side, but they're also looking at improving access in terms of hospitals, accessing gas at the hospitals, particularly in Gauteng. So there's a strong push on towards that with SASL. What SASL likes about what we're doing is on the pyrolysis side, because they would also like to see a low sulfur diesel in the marketplace. And if it's done on a small scale, which you can do with tire pyrolysis, tires produce about 17 ppm sulfur, as opposed to the lowest spec at the moment, which is 50 ppm. So it's a very good product to have, and something that people are very interested in working with us on. I'm going to leave David for a second, but he'll be able to show you a bit of detail about the biogas digesters. What I can do is we can share the draft oil and gas framework report once I think the department is okay. I think there'll be a second report that could be shared with you. It's currently being discussed with the department, so we can discuss it after the meeting, and I can tell you I'll discuss it with the department and keep the conversation later. On the Shell gas side, you can report out of here because the project will open starting in April of this year, the new financial year. The intention is to work with the industry and together with the interdepartmental task team that has been established to look at Shell gas. But we don't operate in isolation, we have to operate in confines of the interdepartmental task team. And the principle behind this is that we will look at, as I said, the resource potential as well as at the environment, the safety environment that we'll be operating in. Governments have offered their support, but I'm also mindful of the comment that was made earlier about, you know, who pays the piper actually plays the tune. So we agree with that. I mean, going to the US, has got a very strong interest in pushing shale gas markets in South Africa because they have a lot of technology that they would like to put in place here. But we're not bound by it. At the end of the day, we are here to learn about shale gas. And so, for instance, Australia has offered their support in working with us at a research level to see if we can't come up with a waterless fracking solution. That is very important because if you can get to a waterless fracking environment, then we have half the environmental problem solved. We may still have other environmental impacts that we haven't studied yet, but at least we will not be contaminating groundwater as has been the case in certain parts of the world. Even the UK has might have been. I've also put a moratorium in place on further exploration at this stage. Okay, in terms of the sewage facility, we have a question about Pomashu. The reason why we chose Pomashu is because of the incinerator plant that's there. That's about a 10 sorts of equipment in place. Having said that, if the direction and the support for the decree is not there, we most happily will move, but we have to accept that the cost for putting in place a power generation plant that can generate up to 2 megawatts of electricity is going to cost about 60 to 65 million. That's more or less what we're looking at, but at least it's sustainable. And this is what we were hoping to achieve in commercial, but if we can't, we are very happy to move elsewhere. And certainly we've been talking to Nelson Mandela Metro. There are facilities in the Eastern Cape where we can act, and we're very happy to come there as well. The same applies to schools. There's no restriction in terms of where we operate. Obviously, budget will always be a factor, but in terms of where we operate in the schools, we've been very happy to look at schools in the Northern Cape, in the Eastern Cape, and everywhere else. Yes, we would like to get them off-grid if possible, but that's going to be very expensive. A solar solution for a school will cost you a few million rand. There's no question about that. And to find that kind of money outside of donors is somewhat tricky. Certainly even the private schools will battle to raise that from the parents and the governing body won't be able to support that. So we are looking at raising means where we can enhance, like I said to David, we'll be looking at biogas that is not David, are you ready to show something? If you can show us.
The first question would be to try to show the previous design of the project. Of the whole and so forth. The CEO mentioned behavioral maps
Limpopo, will be thinking about 110 digesters in the Mpulebo village as part of our initiative. But basically, this is also one household based type of an arrangement where a household with the usage of water and available biomass, you know, can feed the biodigester and then have enough gas to do the cooking, to do lighting, and then to use basic heating. In terms of water, yes, digesters do use water, but what is usually used is grey water, right? It's not water that is, you know, fresh water. So water that would have otherwise, you know, gone down the drain, that's the type of water that is being used. For as long as it does not have bleaches, and then some of the stuff you can kill, you know, the organism that digests the arrangement. And then this type is the one which we have used in what college in Cape, and then basically we have got another two sets in PDP, and these are cast by concrete. Now, this tends to be very, very expensive because almost you bring the whole team of civil engineers, you know, to do the pressure arrangement. So in terms of the cost, it can vary from a highly sophisticated, you know, pressure concrete cast exercise to something which is like in Cameroon or in England, which can be built, you know, almost like to the tune of maybe about 15,000-20,000 rand to about maybe 90,000 rand, you know, for large scale purposes. So one, the skills that have been impacted is possible then for this in terms of, you know, to be rolled out en masse, and then by extension, you know, bringing opportunities a lot of money in terms of energy provision. But let me also say that what a digester does, what a septic tank does, is just that the process is managed differently. Now, instead of just, you know, putting waste into a septic tank with oxygen, what you simply do is you cut off the oxygen. And the process without oxygen then gives you the biogas. So basically, we can combine what is in a septic tank and maybe into a digester. And have two or a few two bits of this one, so basically environmental and human containing waste and energy production. Now, where we use animal waste, we usually use the effluent coming out of it as biofertilizer because it's very, very rich in nutrients. We usually don't advocate for human waste. The effluent from human waste will be used directly into food crops. Usually what is required is a break in the process where you have got, you know, the waste, human waste, and then an animal processing some of the effluent is then conveyed within the plant and then, you know, for human consumption. This is how it is recommended. Now, I've spoken about the PDP project, which is cut, concrete cut. Now, this one is very, very expensive, and we would usually do this for institutions. Then there is another type, which is plastic. And the company which specializes in this is Agama. And the University of Cape Town has got one in one of the residences. And this type is basically feeding into the university. It is pre-cut. So you basically buy this whole thing. And then you dig a hole, you sink it, you feed it. This is how simple it is. The cost is about, in the order of about 35 to about 60,000 rand, depending on the size. This is what the cost would be. Now, in terms of cleaning of stools, basically we then combine the biodigesters with solar water heating, and with the digesters, we usually choose schools which have got feeding arrangements. Basically now the food pills which comes from the feeding kitchen, then those are washed, sliced and washed into the digester, and then they produce this gas, which can then be used in the kitchen for thermal application. And of course, we have got abundance of sand, and then basically any water heating arrangement, what is continuing the application for in the staff room for water can be done with solar water. The difference have got the possibility of giving waste incineration, right? So effectively what we do is to separate your waste at source, and what can be combusted is then incinerated. But we still have sophisticated cladding systems to deal with the nuclear, almost the same as process that, you know, just coming to the own power plant. We haven't been deep into that particular space, and there are a number of projects with the federal government and the Department of Environmental Affairs where they're trying to look at this. The waste energy problem within Saleh is looking at the partnership that we have with GIZ, basically create, you know, skills in such a way that we are almost ready to deal with the issues of waste incineration as the land space for, you know, that field becomes very, very tight. So it's something that is going to be ongoing, but I suppose the biggest challenge is going to be the scrapping of the gas. There are funds which are, well, almost there. They're almost there. I mean, if one wants to use to look at the plant, which is the hectare number, you basically have got the infrastructure which is not used, and if things go well, it could be one of the sites which could be ideal for, you know, waste incineration, because you already have got the two steps, you already have got the imitation, which is already a zone for that particular process. So there are many possibilities that are in terms of waste and waste incineration in the context of, you know, energy production and also environmental relations. So maybe without being too far, say that you say, you know, that's what I want to show you.
Thanks, Shay. If I could just continue. The issue of the smart grid, there's a whole skip approach that has to be taken in terms of the building up of the vision, because each area has got its own grid with its own protocols, its own place, government, implementation. Municipalities have upgraded at their own extremes and done some sometimes differently to what ESCOM has done. So it's all about, you know, putting in the gaps, seeing first of all where there are gaps, and being able to make interventions available as and when we can. So it's not surprising that there are some metros that are far ahead of others. And the city of Joburg is pushing ahead with smart meters at the moment. Nelson Mandela claims to be on top of plans to introduce their own smart meters. So each of them are different, and we'll be working with each one of them to see some of the steps and how best to do that. I think we discussed, the fact that, you know, this is what happened in that respect in any case. On the street lights are difficult because obviously the luminaires, the lighting solutions, are very stringent in terms of the standards and specifications that are required to ensure that the lux levels, the lighting levels, are maintained at the right levels. What we are looking at is high mark lighting, and this has been done in Chuani Metro, but if there is another metro that's willing to partner with us, we'd be very happy to move, because we have not been able to get all the approvals in time as well with Chuani Metro, and if there is some form of security that's required for the project, SEP were initially investors, but the SEP have withdrawn because they went through a process of reprioritizing projects. But essentially, we're looking at 840 high-mark sites that will be retrofitted with what we call an e-box solution. An e-box solution produces about 30%, between 25 and 30% saving electricity for high-mark lighting. And for those areas now, even though there was a bad connotation attached to high-mark lighting from the old days, people are now looking more and more at the security features and saying, well, they actually want high-mark lighting. So we're definitely pushed towards continuing with the use of high-mark lights. So we are looking at that. On the street lighting side, our municipalities are looking at street lighting itself, and we'll be advising them in terms of the choice of luminaires that are required for those particular applications. In terms of the car-free zones, the idea is not to limit access throughout a precinct like Harris Park. There would be a number of streets, maybe three or four streets in a particular area that would have restricted access at certain times of the day. And we would open them up for recreational purposes at certain hours, such as at off-peak periods of the day. But the principle is that we must strive to actually have about three or four streets at least that are demarcated for non-motorized or for electric vehicle type technology. And that helps the spark is what they call the mobile name precinct. It's just adjacent to the spark in the Stanley Bank Arena and the Joburg Stadium. And we're really partnering with the Aerospark management to help green that whole precinct. And the reason why we're doing that is because it becomes a very good model that you can use elsewhere, other stadiums, other little precincts, where you can actually turn that area from a security perspective into something better, or where you can make it into an energy self-sufficient facility as well, which is the other thing we're looking at. They have a very high energy bill, which is an order of about half a million rand per month. And unfortunately, a stadium of that kind cannot be sustained on a electricity bill of that magnitude. So part of what we're doing is looking at ways and means of reducing the electricity bill, also looking at sustainable solar applications and then proper water management inside of the stadium and the other facilities that are linked to the Aerospark precinct. So the motive, the access, the restricted access was actually a part of that exercise. And in terms of LED lamps, I mean, you can get cheap imported LED lamps from China. The problem is that they won't last cheap. And it can vary with what happens. They result in fluctuation in power as well. So from a harmonics point of view, they are not properly compliant with the standards in the country. So what the top suppliers will give you is a product that is guaranteed for a certain number of hours. And they will keep buying. They will replace it. If their lamp doesn't last you for 7 to 10 years, they will replace that lamp. And that's the kind of shortage you unfortunately might have to pay for in the marketplace at present. Now, we don't manufacture LED because the actual chips themselves are all imported. Now, the thing with the diodes are easy enough to assemble and with the chip, but the problem is that we don't have enough scale in the country to warrant bringing international manufacturers in that sector. We always had to be assembling. So what you see here is assembly that's taking place. The guys will put together fittings by using imported LEDs and so on. They all put together their own chips and their own bulbs and everything else. So they're all imported chips. And then on to job creation. Yes, we operate throughout the country. That's the whole premise about working for energy. Obviously, as more funding becomes available, we're able to upscale, replicate what they have shown you. That's more or less on the bioenergy side and the solar side. But there's lots of other areas. The UT Fuel Reactor is a good example where it costs us about 2 million rand to build one of those units that can just generate electricity from biomass. For 5 million rand, we can generate a little bit of electricity, but biofuels as well. So we can do petrol and diesel at the same time. So that's kind of what we're after, is getting to the point where we can build those 5 million rand container-sized facilities with Nexa. Nexa provides a plasma unit that produces the gas, and then we have the intellectual property, which is really what the developers, which originally at Wits University and now at UNISA, where they developed the units that have the right catalyst to produce the liquid fuels under that. E-learning will be introduced as soon as the smart meter pilot is launched. The Department of Energy has to advise us as to the city that we have to work with. As soon as the department advises us, we'll be able to establish the e-learning project within that nature. So it's dependent upon the city, on the department at the station. Onto the CNG side, we've had to work only in the areas where we can have access to natural gas. So in Kharkin we have access to gas from the Gordon gas. If you go anywhere else, you're going to have to either pipe the gas or you can transport it in pods. So we have done projects where we've got these little pods that are moved from site to site and they're
to Paris, maybe say Paris in the fire, and to see some of these children, it will really be, it's life changing. And for us, it's about giving something back into communities where children have been negatively affected by energy, and showing them there's a better side to energy. So, yes, I don't think we do enough on that side in terms of employing people with disabilities, but we are trying to reach out to communities as well as much as we can. The jewel, I think we've discussed the jewel, and in terms of where we can go. In terms of intellectual property, the way we work is mainly applied research. We do new innovative research. That's generally what we call fundamental, blue sky research. Now, the Department of Science and Technology has taken custodianship of that. And they say that everything that's been done under that banner is supported by them. And so, as far as we're not allowed to play in that space, but our focus has been more on taking new innovation that's out there and then say adapting it where possible for what I think we need. So there's really sort of the way of new intellectual property. If a donor had to put money forward for a development of a local solution that had intellectual property, the intellectual property would resign with us because their agreements would not allow them to hold the intellectual property, particularly if it's considered to be donor assistance. They're not allowed to hold the intellectual property. If it's a collaborative effort between universities, then they would share the intellectual property. But that's only for another university from outside has to work on the project with us. And then I think in terms of are we able to motivate moving forward, I think most definitely, I think there are certain niche areas where Canadian is the lead in the country. So carbon capture and storage, we are the lead. Green transport, we are the lead. Smart goods, we are the lead. In a number of other areas, we play a major coordinating role, whether it's renewable energy or energy efficiency, and working for energy, we once again be the lead in that space. So as we're moving along, we think that this is more and more that has to be done to move us to this low carbon future. And it's a case of, well, when the funding materializes, then it will expand to include other areas that perhaps haven't been adequately dealt with. But for now, I think we certainly are making a difference. Obviously, there's a lot more to be done. But I think we have to revisit the intention behind creating Canadian. I think Canadian is living up to the expectation. Perhaps not as much as we would like to, but then I think we have to start somewhere. Canadian's only been in existence since April of 2011. And Canadian, before that, it was Canadian with a completely different focus at the end of the day. And in terms of in the, let's say, National Energy Fund, or so, I guess, which has been proposed previously, our intention was to work with National Treasury if they were going to introduce a carbon tax. Because for the first time, Treasury has said they will be looking at earmarking a tax, which you know they don't want to earmark tax. Everything has to go into the National Energy Fund. Now they've been saying if there's a carbon tax, they'll be willing to look at the ways and means of utilizing those funds to help clean up the environment, which puts all of our efforts under that umbrella. In fact, right now, Canadian has got a number of programs that are under what we call the National Climate Change Response Strategy. And so the flagship programs like carbon capture and storage, working for energy, energy efficiency, are all housed as well under this National Climate Change Response Strategy. And so for us, the carbon tax became the mechanism to do that. I don't think there's an appetite for more levies at the moment. Yeah, this doesn't seem to be that. I mean, even for liquid fuels, even a 1 cent per litre face to raise eyebrows, even though really is nothing in the bigger scheme of things. So, but if the carbon tax goes ahead, that's certainly a mechanism that I think needs to be explored. Chair, I think I've tried to answer most of the questions that have been raised. If there are any others, I'm happy to see them as well, but I think those are the main ones that I think.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Thank you. I just wanted to know on the high mark lighting, because in the area where I am, a couple of years ago, one of the most popular things to have was the drug reason, but then it was removed because of people feeding on purpose. What is the cost involved to especially at the high mark lighting? I just need to know the benefits.
Chairperson, all these things that we hear is wonderful and it's good, and I think it's great that Canadian is doing this work naturally with the support of Department of Energy. But I think it's important to have a bigger debate about where we're going with alternative energy and all the issues around it in South Africa. The reality is that South Africa has established itself as one of the most lucrative opportunity in the alternative fuels in the world. It was just now, when we were in Spain, once again, reconfirmed. That's why you have these stampede of international investors, which is right. But the biggest challenge that we experience is that many of the initiatives that's in the broader sort of political agenda are not addressed, because we don't do the right things in terms of the mandate of Sanelli, one of the mandates, and that is to search and develop. One of the things that we're losing out is the issue about local content and localization. Local content and localization. Now, we hear the wonderful initiatives of Treasury, from 12i, and all those potential windfalls and so on. But the reality, Chairperson, if we leave Sanelli with this limited budget, the research institutions and Sanelli itself can't do what they're supposed to do, and that is to be at the front end of being innovative. And I seriously, Chairperson, want to motivate that, given the fact that we now in the budget cycle, Treasury is now preparing for the adjustment appropriation law. I really, really think, Chairperson, it's a serious matter, and I just hope it supports my motivation. I really, really want to request this committee to engage with the Appropriations Committee of the NCOP to have a debate with the president and the official administration that we look at the budget of Sanelli naturally through the Department of Energy and Environmental. If we're going to leave it like this, it will be another year in terms of the cycle and nothing will be done. Because I don't know, CEO, you must tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems that you actually running, in terms of your best scenario perspective, you actually running at a tenth of your budget. And it's not about you, Sanelli, per se. It's about the research capacity that we've got in this country through the university. So I want to formally propose, Chairperson, given the fact that the opposition is taking over here now, I hope that they will support me, that we engage the Appropriations Committee and that we engage National Treasury and that we put on our agenda an item that we invite National Treasury to come to our committee and ask them, and even if we must bring in Sanelli once again, to come and do a motivation to say, but you know, we're grateful for the fact that we've got, but it can't continue like that. So from my side, say that is hopefully a formal proposal, if I can put it like that. There was another issue. Oh yeah, say the issue, the one issue that I think that Sanelli is also missing out is a non-tangible issue. How do we, Mr. CEO and your team, how do you measure how South Africa is doing in terms of the international objectives, the one that's been sort of tentatively agreed at COP17 and later COP18 and so on? What do you do? Is there a best practice manual? Is there a knowledge portal, if you like, where potential people can invest? You referred to many of the local authorities, and you said Ikwemi is not so hot, but Nelson Mandela is maybe a bit hotter, and Cape Town is a bit hotter, and so on. Is there room for something to measure? Because at some critical stage, we must have the debate in South Africa about how are we doing in terms of addressing many of these, what I always call the non-tangible issues. Thank you.
Thanks for the welcome, Craig. I think on your proposal, we don't have to
one of the key conditions that the independent power producers program should meet is the local content in terms of the South African national standard 1250. So we can send that instruction note to your secretariat in terms of like how we speak in compliance in terms of the local content. So the like with respect to the tender, there was a tender that has just been cancelled from Eskom so that it complies with that threshold in terms of the local content. So what would be issued would be in line with that 70% local content.
Well, we haven't decided yet.
Working with the World Bank and a number of indicators for renewables, for energy efficiency,
and then just to thank the committee as well for the offer of assistance in engaging with Tricia as well.
No,
if you
skipped anything, we'll call you back, don't worry. We'll let you sleep in Cape Town. Members, have all your questions been answered? Honorable Sinclair?
Yes, thank you, sir.
Honorable Birmingham? Okay. I didn't hear Facebook or something. Honorable Edwards? How can you answer? Covered? Good. Honorable Birmingham? Oh, beautiful smile, thank you. On a Tuesday. So the weekend was good in case to be. Mr. Nasib, any passing shots from your side?
Just other thing to reiterate our apologies for missing the last meeting, and certainly just to thank the committee for availing itself today and allowing us the opportunity and audience to present on what we are doing, and we look forward to further engagement with the committee in this regard.
Better with 6 million to the gangsters. So mining in Dara, which we're going to do an application for the 28th, I think it's the 28th to 29th, 30th or the 27th, 28th to 29th, in Central Hawke, yeah, it's in Hawke, isn't it? Pretoria. Oh, okay. So we'll do the application that will keep you informed of what the process are and all that. The secretariat will get in touch with you, your availability and stuff like that. Thank you very much to Saneri, to the DDG, it's always been welcome. She's no more guest. She's one of the family of this committee of economic development in the HCOP. But you were not around. We wanted to take you along, but they sent us also someone to go along. But DDG, next time we'll go back, we'll definitely take you along. Members, if there's nothing else, Zubair? Nothing else is very in your subject. Okay. Thank you, Saleni. Thank you, honorable members. This meeting very thanks, Chan. Thank you. And remember, you must finish back there, otherwise we'll talk to Saleni.
I see this on a statement. What's his name on the program for 5 o'clock in the morning? heard this.
No, no, we'll see you again.